inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for joining me on this Thursday afternoon right before Christmas. Coming up, man, just right around the corner. Hope you have a great weekend. And then, of course, a wonderful Christmas next week. Won't be with you next week. We'll be doing Christmas programming all week. So looking forward to that as well. But this afternoon, I want to try to hit some of these topics that have happened in the last 48 hours since Walker sat in with me on Tuesday. And then also, you know, I'm going to actually kind of blow through some of those pretty quickly. Specifically want to talk about this continuing resolution. And then I've got a guest that I'm going to share with you, Bill Federer. And many of you have probably heard him before. I mentioned it on Tuesday with Walker and just got to thinking, you know what, let me let Bill share all that history that is just really cool about Christmas and how we got to where we are with our Christmas celebration. Because we're often told it's all pagan. None of it is based on Christianity in any way, shape, or form. There's just a lot of misinformation out there. And I thought it'd be really cool if we went through that with Bill Federer. So we're going to talk about his book on Saint Nick and that whole story. But let's get to the headlines first. This whole thing with the continuing resolution, the outrage is warranted. I mean, I've made it pretty clear, you know, I'm a fan of Mike Johnson and his faith and his constitutionalism and his track record prior to being speaker. As speaker, it's hard for me to tell, to be honest with you, because it is an impossible job to do what he's got to do right now with a, you know, two vote majority, one vote majority, three vote majority, whatever it is day to day based on who's retiring or being appointed or whatever. And it's just an impossible task. And so I hesitate in my criticism. And if you listen to this program at all, you know, I am an equal opportunity critic. I don't care if they're Republican, Democrat. I don't care if they're conservative or liberal. I don't care if they're Christian or non-Christian. I do it based on the principles that they are either for or against and the actions that they take, whether it's good strategy or not. And I have hesitated. I've been unapologetic. I mean, I've criticized Johnson several times during his speakership where I thought the strategy was way too weak and we should have been throwing down the gauntlet and saying we're not going to pass anything. For instance, unless you secure the elections, unless you at least at a minimum say that you've got to be a U.S. citizen to vote. Big things like that. At any rate, this continuing resolution thing is also very complicated. So it's hard to just say it shouldn't have happened. I mean, I take that back. It's easy to say there should never be a continuing resolution. I totally agree. I mean, listen, 1997, I think, is the last time we actually passed a spending bill on time. It's crazy that we do these continuing resolutions. So totally agree with conceptually, should never happen. Totally agree with conceptually, they should only be funding the government through January 20. You know, or maybe through February 1st, and President Trump should have a bite at the apple immediately based on the massive change that was just voted in. Absolutely believe that they should not pass spending bills that would lock things in through the end of 2025. And I think that's the complicating factor here, is that maybe, and here I'm very much trying to just look behind the scenes here, and I do not say this as an expert at all. I was a state legislator, not a federal legislator. So I have not served in Congress. I have a lot of my graduates that are staff in Congress or members of Congress or, you know, involved in that a lot. We do a lot with a lot of congressmen. So we are in and around that. But I'm not an expert on how their process works, especially in terms of these continuing resolutions. What I detest is these deals being made by a handful in each chamber and the White House, and then thrown at the members of Congress the night before the vote. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 page bills. I detest that. I think it is wrong. It is evil. I think it is anti-constitutional republic, not anti-democratic. anti-constitutional republic. It's not allowing the elected representatives of the people to vote on these bills in an informed manner. And it is absolutely wrong. So for that, I don't think there is an excuse in the world that would make sense. I mean, Mike Johnson has always said he's against this stuff. And it's part of the reason that we had the change in the speakership in the first place. So that part is, I just see as indefensible. I don't think there's any way to argue that it has to be done in this way where it's, you know, these guys are given no chance whatsoever to actually review this. I think it is absolutely wrong that they would, not involve more of the members early on in this process. So here's my position. Shut it down. Shut down the federal government. A shutdown does not mean that essential services are shut down. It does not mean that the military is suddenly standing down. They have all kinds of backup measures for all of those things. It's a shell game. It's a sham. They do this to get the stuff they want at the last minute. And they have lit this thing up like a Christmas tree. They have horrible things in this bill, just from what we do know so far. It's 1,547 pages. And it's inexcusable. So I say shut it down. If you cannot give the members the time to vote, then people have to stop getting their checks. People have to, most of these agencies shouldn't exist in the first place anyway. Frankly, if 3/4 of the federal government went home and never came back, America would be blessed. Your life would be better. I promise you, it would be better. The lack of harassment that would suddenly exist, the freedom people would experience with these bureaucratic nightmares gone, or at least defanged by not having the money to do anything, it would actually be a blessing. So I say shut it down and get to, and if you want to shut it down until January 20th, that's fine. But shut it down until you get something that the members have a chance to review. That ought to be the minimum requirement in this situation. Now, apparently, Elon Musk has come out against this thing. Donald Trump is now saying that he opposes this funding bill. J.D. Vance, I don't know. I don't know what they're specifically pushing for. I'm sure we're going to learn more later today, and it will become clear. But I'm just glad that they're saying no. Here's the thing that they have recognized. There's a lot of things snuck into this bill to protect the very people Donald Trump and J.D. Vance were elected to remove from the federal government, to defang, to defund. So this is a chance for the left through Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and all of these yahoos to sneak in a bunch of things that would tie Donald Trump's hands and keep him from implementing what we elected him to do. So that's it. That's all I got to say on that. We'll see what happens in the next 48 hours, but I am praying that Speaker Johnson will change his position and that this absurdity will come to an end, including, in my opinion, favorably, a shutdown if necessary. So anyway, that's that. All right, let's jump in. Let's get back to it. Let's get back to a better topic because this is my last chance to visit with you before Christmas, since we're going to be doing Christmas music next Tuesday on Christmas Eve. So listen, Bill Federer is an amazing patriot, incredible man, amazing man of God, just awesome. I love this guy. I've loved him for years and have had the chance to share the stage with him many times over the years. And I've seen him a lot more over the last couple of years because we've just been in the same circles going and doing things, and just super honored to call him friend. And so let's jump in. Here's an interview I just cut with him. It's going to air on Wall Builders next week, but we're going to give you a chance to hear it this afternoon. So here's Bill Federer. Going to get some history on Christmas. Hey, Bill, Merry Christmas, brother.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
Well, thank you, man. So this is a great time where you hear all kinds of things. There's some people say Christmas is purely pagan and secular. We don't do that. And others are, really involved in celebrating Christmas. We have, different views out there. So we're like, hey, let's get Bill on. He could tell us more of the history of St. Nick and this whole thing. So, man, thanks for coming on and sharing today.
Yeah. I put together a book. It's called There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. And of course, I start off talking about December 25th, and the Jews did not celebrate birthdays. Even Josephus said, we do not make a festival of our children's birth. It wasn't until Gentiles started converting to Christianity that they asked the question, when was he born? And so it's sort of a little detective project. So the clue is Zechariah is John the Baptist's dad, and he's in the temple, and he's of the division of Abijah. And then, okay, what's this? David broke the Levites into 24 priestly groups. And but we don't know, we know their order, but we don't know when they start and how it worked. And so when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, it had the sacerdotal rota system. And it said that these 24 groups would serve 2 weeks a year, 6 months apart. It's like, okay, we got another hint, but when did these weeks start? Well, then we piece in another piece. Josephus documents that when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed, the date in the Roman calendar was August 4th, 70 AD, and he mentions that the priestly tribe of Jehoiarib was on duty. Okay, there's the clue. Jehoiarib was
at least a starting point where you can then clock everybody through and figure out when. Okay, yeah.
So Jehoiarib is of the first priestly division, and if that's the first week of August, now we can count off, and Abijah was on duty the last week of September. And so this important week, it's the month of Tishri, it's the Day of Atonement at the beginning of the week, Feast of Tabernacles, end of the week, and then Zechariah comes out, and his wife gets pregnant, and then the Bible says that 6 months of Elizabeth's pregnancy is when the angel appeared to Mary, and she went and visited. So 6 months after the last week of September is the last week of March, and so March 25th is the traditional date of the Annunciation, when the angel announced to Mary she was going to conceive, and then 9 months after March 25th. This is December 25th, right? So that's their...
So it is December 26th. So I was also always hear around this time, right, that, oh, we have it all wrong on the date, and it's actually some... So you're saying, actually, based on the only evidence we can find that we can nail down those dates, that December 25th is accurate.
Yeah, that's the evidence that I present in the book. And then you begin to have church leaders like Telephorus and all these different names, Hypocleitus. But we're beginning in 136 AD, they begin to make statements that December 25th is the birth of Christ. And they also thought that that was also the day that he was crucified. So for these early centuries, even St. Augustine said the Savior was conceived on the same, and then he died on the anniversary of his inception. So 181 AD, you got another church father saying we should celebrate Christmas on December 25th, no matter which day of the week it falls on. And so we have these acknowledgments. Well, it was not until 274 AD that Roman Emperor Aurelian instituted the Feast of Sol Invictus. The Sol means sun, and Invictus means unconquerable or invincible. And so the thought is maybe Christians didn't pick the date of December 25th to overlap the pagan date. Maybe it was the pagans picking the date to overlap the Christian date. Sort of like Kwanzaa. So Ron Everett, 1966, a woke California professor, created Kwanzaa specifically to be an alternative to Christmas. Huh. Right? He specifically wanted to. And so the idea was that Christianity was spreading, and there are 10 major persecutions of Roman emperors trying to stamp out Christianity. And so it would only fall in line that here's a Roman emperor wanting to stamp it out by putting his... And then some say, well, it was the winter solstice. Well, no, that's December 22nd. If you're going to pick a date, sol means sun, stis means still. And so it's the elliptical orbits, the furthest away the sun, the earth is from the sun in the winter. But that's December 22nd, right? Opposite June 22nd, the longest day of the year. And then some say, well, there's sheep in the... There wouldn't be shepherds in the field in the wintertime. The climate of Bethlehem is the same as Dallas, Texas, huh. Right? It gets cold, but it's not frigid. And besides, Bethlehem is near Jerusalem, about six miles away.
Dallas, Texas,
and they needed lambs all year round for sacrifices. And then I even found some agricultural websites where they're saying lambing can begin as early as December and go on till June. And then another website says lambs gestate for 145 days and they're late summer, what they call it, long day, short night breeders. And so they begin to mate late summer, and then 145 days later is late December and into the spring. So, I trace the story of Santa Claus in the book. And so he's the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. He is to the Greek Orthodox what St. Peter is to Roman Catholics. And he lived during Roman times and was persecuted. Now, a movement was sweeping through Christianity in the third century when Nicholas lived, called monasticism.
All right, folks, got to interrupt. You'll have to find out what monasticism is when we come back from the break. You're listening to Bill Federer join me to discuss Christmas and the history of a lot of our traditions. We'll be right back. You're listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Bill Federer with me today, and we were talking about some of those Christmas traditions, a lot of that history, so many things that we just have lost over the years, and a lot of confusion that's out there. So let's jump right back in with Bill Federer.
In the third century when Nicholas lived, called monasticism. And it was this concept that if you really become a Christian, you should follow Jesus' advice to the rich young ruler and give away all your money to the poor and come and follow me. And so you would have these people converting to Christianity, giving their money away, and then joining monasteries. And so this is what Nicholas did, but he didn't want to give the money away and get the credit for it. So he would sneak into town at nighttime and throw money in the window of poor people. It's a hard sell to tell kids, oh, Santa's Satan. See, you can change the letters around. It's like, yeah, but Santa Fe means holy faith and Santa Barbara. I mean, they're all Santa means sanctify or holy. And then the kids are like, yeah, but my little neighbor boy is getting all these presents and I can't. And we raised our daughter and we told her, she goes, I felt like I got cheated, you know, because we didn't have it. So the idea is, let's see what we can redeem. Now, Halloween, you can't redeem. It's pagan to the core.
Right,
But the Christmas story, there's something there. So St. Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. He lived during Roman times, and he is to Greek Orthodox what St. Peter is to Roman Catholics. He's sort of like a founding father of their Greek Orthodox church. And so a movement was sweeping through Christianity in this third century called monasticism. And it was not just, you know, emphasizing an experience with Jesus, you know, not just doctrine, but it was a consciousness that you want to strive to every moment be conscious of the Lord. And anyway, the Christians would get saved and they would want to follow the advice that Jesus gave to the rich young ruler. One thing you lack, go and sell all, give to the poor and come and follow me. And so you would have these Christians getting saved and giving away their money and joining monasteries or living as hermits in caves. And so Nicholas decided to give away his money, but he didn't want to do it publicly and get all the credit for it. So he would sneak into the town of poor people and throw money in the window. Supposedly it would land in her shoe, in the shoe or a stocking that's drying by the fireplace. He gives away his money, goes to the Holy Land. He's about to join this order. He does visit the Church of the Nativity, which is over where Jesus was born. So you could have the picture, little, you know, Santa kneeling at the manger there. But right before he takes his vows, somehow the Lord tells him not to hide his light under a bushel. In a sense, monasticism was their version of separation of church and state. It was, okay, I'm just going to be me and God, and I'm not going to care about the world. But he decides he's going to care about the world. And so he goes back to Asia Minor, gets off at a big port city called Myra. And unbeknownst to him, the bishop had died. And the other, they couldn't decide who the next bishop was going to be. And one had a dream. The first person to church the next day would be named Nicholas, and he was to be the bishop. Well, he was the first person to church. They asked him his name, and he was not too thrilled because the Roman Emperor Diocletian was arresting bishops and killing them. So it was sort of like, you be the bishop. No, you first. No, seriously, you be the
you first.
And so he's arrested, he's put in jail. And then lo and behold, Christians pray and the Roman Emperor Diocletian gets struck with an intestinal disease and abdicates the throne on May 1st, 305 AD. I mean, here's the emperor stepping down. The next emperor is Galerius. He continues the persecution. He's struck with an intestinal disease and dies. Now you have a toss-up between four generals. Constantine wins the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, 312 AD. Supposedly the day before the battle, he saw the sign of Christ in the sky and put it on all of his shields. And the sign was the first two Greek letters for the name Christ. So in Hebrew, it's Messiah. If you translate it into Greek, it's Christus or Christ. And the letter that makes the ka sound is written as an X. It's called Chi. And the letter that makes the R sound is written as a big P, and it's called Rho. So it's called the Chi Rho. And so you'll see this X and a P over it. Well, those are the first two Greek letters for the name Christ. Interestingly, as the centuries went on, it got shortened just to the Chi, the X, and it was called the Christ's Cross or Crisscross. And that's where you get Xmas. So X is not crossing out Christ. It's the Greek letter that stood for Christ. And then it became part of a written oath. Swear to tell the truth, cross my heart. And you'd sign it, the X, right, the Christ cross. And then they'd kiss it to show sincerity. And that's the X's and the O's on the bottom of a Valentine. And anyway, so Constantine, 313, Edict of Milan, Christians are now legalized. Nicholas comes out of jail and he preaches against Diana worship, right? In Ephesus is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the temple to Diana, twice as big as the Parthenon, 127 huge pillars and temple prostitutes. It was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean. Wow. The Apostle Paul preached against Diana worship in Acts chapter 19. And so the people tear the temple to Diana down. He preaches against an exposure of unwanted infants. It's their version of abortion. They'd leave an unwanted child out to die. And then he preached against the Olympics. And you think, why? Well, they ran them naked, right? They'd wrestle naked. The word gym for gymnasium means naked. I won't get into it all, but he preaches against it. And then there's miracles attributed to him. And if you get into the Greek Orthodox history, they have lots and lots of stuff on Nicholas, but some's more believable than others. But one, there was a famine and ships would come from North Africa through Asia Minor on their way to Rome. He talks some of the sailors into unloading their grain to feed his people and promises God will bless them. Well, on their return trip, they said the grain that was left had multiplied. They had more than enough. Sort of like the Elijah story with the widow and the meal barrel that didn't run dry. And then there was a storm and the sailors couldn't get back. They get Nicholas. He prays. The sea becomes calm. And then the, there was a corrupt governor.
And these stories about Nicholas, are they in your book as well?
Yeah. So this corrupt governor was about to execute some soldiers to cover up his corruption. We're familiar with politicians and body count lists and suicided and so forth. And Nicholas hears about the execution, goes down to the square, busts through the crowd, grabs the sword out of the executioner's hand, throws it down. And then by the power of the Holy Spirit, knowledge given him, he tells everybody what the governor had done. The governor knows only God could know the details. And he begs Nicholas to pray for him. Then there's the Arian heresy. A bishop named Arius said Jesus was a little less than God, a created being, writes a catchy song. The Visigoths start converting to Arianism, and it splits the church and it splits the Roman Empire because Constantine had made Christianity the de facto religion of the empire.
Yeah.
And so Constantine says, hey, guys, settle this. So he pays for all the bishops to come together for the first time ever in Nicaea. They settle it. It's called the Nicene Creed. And the tradition is that Nicholas slapped Arius for starting the Arian heresy. So jolly old St. Nick had a temper.
Wow.
We'll see some old icon pictures on these Greek Orthodox churches.
I remember the scene in Kirk Cameron's Christmas movie like 5 or 6 years ago. I can't remember when it was that he had it. And it was, and he did this. He reenacted this scene of Nicholas slapping this guy. So that's the backstory of it right there. So it was, I didn't realize it had split all the way up and Constantine actually called the Nicene Council. I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yeah. And so he dies on December 6th, 343 AD. Greeks would give presents. The next emperor, or a couple of them, Justinian builds a big church. He builds the Hagia Sophia. It's still there. They just turned it into a mosque. But he builds a church in Myra, the city Nicholas was, and names it for him. And that's still there. It's just in ruins. And then in 988 AD, Vladimir the Great converts from paganism to Greek Orthodox Christianity and adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. And then Islam comes in and destroys all seven churches that mentioned in the book of Revelation in Asia Minor. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, all wiped out. And when they would come in, they would destroy churches and graves. People forget in 846 AD, 11,000 Muslim Saracen pirates come up the Tiber River and trash Rome and trash the Basilica of St. Peter's and St. Paul, right? The churches of St. Paul outside the walls. And they trash the graves of St. Peter and St. Paul. Wow. After this, Pope Leo IV built a 39-foot wall around the Basilica of St. Peter's. But the threat of these in Muslim invaders destroying the grave of St. Nicholas was real. So in 1087, they move his grave to Italy, a little town called Bari, B-A-R-I, and the cathedral is still there, Cattedrale Niccolo de Bari. And it's dedicated by Pope Urban II. And you know him because he's the one that called for the First Crusade. at the Council of Clermont in 1095 AD, saying, hey, we got to rescue these Greeks. But now that Nicholas's traditions are in Italy, St. Francis of Assisi, sort of in protest, comes up with a nativity scene, 1223 AD, saying gift giving is fine, but we need to get back to the real reason for the season. Jesus, the Son of God, was born in the manger. So whenever you see a nativity scene, that's St. Francis of Assisi came up with that. Wow. And then Reformation starts 1517, Martin Luther. And by this time, there's a saint's day for every day of the year. Churches are filled with side altars and relics of saints, little pieces of bone or hair. And Martin Luther considered all this a distraction from Christ. So he ends all the saint's days. But the Germans like the gift giving. So he moves all the gift giving to December 25th and says all gifts come from the Christ child. And the German pronunciation of Christ child is Christkindl. Like kindergarten, kindercare, Christ means Christ, and Kindle means child, so Christ child. Over the centuries, Christkindl got pronounced Kris Kringle. So Kris Kringle is really Christkindl, which means Christ child. I go into the history of the tree. So St. Patrick left Britain around 400 AD and evangelized Druid Ireland and used a three-leaf clover to teach the Trinity. Well, from Britain in the 700s, St. Boniface, also called Winfrid, evangelized the Germans. Now, the Germans were pagan and they worshiped Thor. And that's where you get Thor's Day or Thursday. And Thor lived in a big oak tree in Geismar, Germany. Matter of fact, the Quakers wouldn't say Thursday because it was pagan God Day. So they called it Fifth Day, right? And but St. Boniface chops down Thor's tree. And then he points to an evergreen tree and says, let this be the tree of the Christ child. See how it points toward heaven. Your houses are built of fir. Its leaves are evergreen. And so the evergreen tree became symbolic of Germans converting to Christianity, the same way the three-leaf clover is symbolic of the Irish converting to Christianity. And but Martin Luther's the one credited with coming home one day, singing stars twinkling, and puts the candles and said, this is like the sky above Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth. Now we go to England and Henry VIII, and he brings the Reformation, not because he wanted to focus on the Christ child. He just wanted another wife, went on to have six wives. And so he brings back an old Roman holiday, Saturnalia. Rome had been a British, Britain had been a Roman colony since 55 BC. Julius Caesar invaded. And so Saturn was their god of feasting and plenty and merriment. If you remember the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens,
yeah,
there's the ghost of Christmas present. And he's a big fat guy with robes on, a wreath in his hair, a goblet of wine, grapes and everything. And you're looking at him saying, who is this guy? He sort of looks like Santa, but he sort of looks like some Roman god. Well, that was Saturn, but they Christianized him, called him Father Christmas. Huh. They couldn't call him St. Nicholas because St. Nicholas was outlawed because of the Reformation. And so Christmas in England under Henry VIII was bawdy. He had these big banquets with 60 courses, and he'd fling sugar plums at people. Huh. And they would have court jesting and throwing dice and bear baiting, where they put bears in a pit, sort of like dog fighting to the death. And they would have cross-dressing and mock bishops, boy bishops. They boys dress up as the bishops. And it was just, you know, chasing women, carousing, drinking, dancing, wassailing, where they'd take a drink of spiced ale and throw the rest of it on an apple tree for a good harvest, you know, good. Huh. And so the Puritans come along and they decide that Christmas is worldly. It's like Mardi Gras.
Because of how it's been perverted. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Henry even had a Lord of Misrule, exactly like Mardi Gras. Hmm. Right. And so, matter of fact, Mardi Gras started as a religious day. It was the day before Lent when you would fast 40 days before you'd celebrate the resurrection of Christ. And now it's a lewd party in New Orleans. That's sort of what happened to Christmas in England under Henry VIII. So the Puritans come along and they outlaw Christmas. They even tear down Shakespeare's Globe Theater in 1644. And so the Puritans settled New England and they had a 5-shilling fine for anybody caught celebrating Christmas.
You're kidding.
And so the Pilgrims, Puritans, and most Presbyterians did not celebrate Christmas, but other immigrants did. German, French, Welsh, Irish, Italian, but especially the Dutch. Now, this is where it gets interesting. The same way that Catholics have a saying, St. Peter's at the gates of heaven, the Dutch do a take on the book of Revelation. where Jesus will return at the end of the world to judge the living and the dead, riding a white horse. Saints will come back with him riding white horses, right? Jude chapter 1:14, it says, and the Lord will return with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment. And so the reasoning is that Saint Nicholas is a saint. So he will be one of those riding a white horse coming back with Jesus at the final judgment. But since he's so special to the Dutch, they have him coming back once a year for a little mini judgment day, a little checkup on the kids, see who's naughty, see who's nice.
A little naughty or nice, yeah.
And just like the real judgment day, the books are opened, right? The Lamb's Book of Life, the Book of Works, and he's judging these little kids. And then as time went on, the angels turned into elves. Saints come from heaven that turned into the North Pole. Riding a horse up in Finland and Lapland, it turned into riding a reindeer and then pulling a sleigh. And you can see where it gets a little off track.
Yeah.
One thing the Dutch had was... now, St. Nicholas in the Dutch pronunciation is Sant Niklaus, right? Sinterklaas. So Santa Claus is the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas. And so they have a helper named Zwarte Piet, Black Peter, and he's a Moor. He's a Muslim. And they would tell the children, if you're good, St. Nicholas will give you a present. If you're naughty, Zwarte Piet will put you in a gunny sack, take you back to Spain, and sell you into Muslim slavery.
Wow.
People forget Muslims controlled Spain for 700 years and enslaved over 1 million Europeans.
That's a little bit worse than a lump of coal.
Yeah. I'd love to have tormented my little brothers with that one. I was doing a radio interview call-in, and a guy calls in and says, I was raised in Holland, and the night before St. Nicholas visited, all the boys would go to sleep with pocket knives in their pockets. I said, why is that? He goes, that's to cut ourselves out of the gunny sack, right?
Just thinking ahead, man, having that pocket knife in there. Anyway, we're gonna take a break. Bill Federer is our special guest. We're learning about a lot of these Christmas traditions and the history on those things, how it came to be, sometimes just strictly by accident. But there's a lot of cool history here. We're gonna take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. You're listening to At the Core with Waka Wauman and Rick Green.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
We're back here on At the Core with Waka Wauman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for staying with me on this Thursday. Bill Federer, our guest today. We're learning about a lot of the history of Christmas, a lot of these things that, of course, get exaggerated, and no doubt there's, you know, things mixing with secular and Christian tradition, and, you know, we just need to be wise, and we need to be able to pick those things apart and know what the good stuff is, leave out the bad stuff, and honestly, not be uptight about it, but, you know, look for how we can in any way, shape, or form point people to Christ, whether that's, you know, specifically the actions of someone like Saint Nick, or it's other things. But I just love learning this history. It makes a lot of things make sense. Let's jump right back in with Bill Federer.
Anyway, so the Dutch, the patron saint of Amsterdam is Saint Nicholas. Why? He's remember he calmed the sea back in the story. So he's considered the patron saint of sailors. And so the Dutch settle New Amsterdam, and they make St. Nicholas the patron saint of New Amsterdam, which becomes New York. And the first church they built in New Amsterdam was the St. Nicholas Dutch Reformed Church. And when the British took over in 1664, they moved it, they burnt it, and they moved it again and again. Finally, they built a big cathedral at on Fifth Avenue in New York. Teddy Roosevelt attended there.
No kidding.
But in the 1930s and 40s, it turned into a financial district, church membership dwindled, and they sold the church to Sinclair Oil Company that tore it down and built a big oil building. The congregation had moved and merged with the Marble Collegiate Dutch Reformed Church. And so it's like the second oldest church in New York. And many are familiar with Norman Vincent Peale was the pastor from 1933 till he died. And who went to that church but the Trump family?
No
interestingly
kidding.
Enough. So in New York, we see another transition. Washington Irving. He is the father of American literature. He wrote Rip Van Winkle, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, invented the name Gotham to describe New York. And he
talks about these traditions. There's an old book that it's no longer in print, but it tells how St. Nicholas would visit once a year in his flying his wagon over the treetop, throwing out presents to his favorites. But then he describes him not dressed as a bishop, but dressed in a Dutch outfit of Flemish trousers, long trunk hose, the baggy pants. He has a stocking hat, boots, and a leather belt. But he's still called St. Nicholas.
So that imagery didn't, so that was what 40s, 50s was when he did that?
That was 1809.
Oh, 1809. Okay, so that imagery of him began 200 years. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
And so the book is called Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York from the Beginning to the End of the Dutch Dynasty.
Huh.
And so basically it's the 1640s up through the 1660s.
What do you think is the most important thing to hold on to out of all of those traditions and all those, like you said, sometimes it went off the rails or sometimes it got a little bit crazy and some of it's just fun. I mean, what do you think is good for people to still hold on to and use? I mean, obviously the birth of Christ and the story of Christ, but using some of what St. Nick did and trying to tap into some of those traditions that people are used to.
So he is alive. He's in heaven. He believes in Jesus. Doesn't come back once a year, but he's a Christian and he loves Jesus so much. He went into the ministry and he was willing to go into Roman prison and not deny his faith.
Yeah.
And he stood up for the Trinity. He defended the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. He confronted corrupt politicians. He preached against the pagan Diana worship. He would have been preaching against all the woke sexual agenda today. Preached against exposure of unwanted infants. He would have been a pro-life preacher today. But what we were—
stood up against fellow theologians, right? And was willing to, yeah.
Yeah, and we remember him most because he was generous and gave to the poor, and he wanted God to get the credit and not him.
That's good.
So he's a great example there. But in the book, I go through all these different traditions. And
remind me the title of the book.
It's called There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. I go through all the things. For 2,000 years, it was the most kings would get crowned on Christmas Day, like Clovis, King of the Franks in 496 AD. 10,000 Anglo-Saxons got baptized on Christmas Day in 597 by St. Augustine of Canterbury. And you had Charlemagne is crowned Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day in the year 800. William the Conqueror got crowned in Westminster Abbey on Christmas Day in the year 1066. This was like the day.
Yeah.
So I go through all the history. But again, the most important thing is that we acknowledge that. Matter of fact, Harry S. Truman lit the national Christmas tree. And he says we celebrate the birth of Christ. And he goes, shepherds keeping their watch by their flocks at night. And the angels appear, glory to God in the highest. And he says, the star of faith will guide us into the place of peace as it did the shepherds 2,000 years ago when the prophecy of Isaiah was fulfilled. Right? Here's Truman. He was a Baptist, but he's talking about the prophecy was fulfilled. And then I go through other things that happen on Christmas. I mean, even Apollo 8 circles the moon on Christmas Eve of 1968, and they read from the first chapter of Genesis, and then they wish America Merry Christmas. And even the James Webb Telescope was launched on Christmas Day in 2021.
Man.
And I actually met the guy that was in charge of the launch. He talked about how they were moving everything down to South America and they were going to launch it from there. But he picked the date and he wanted it to be on December 25th. So now it joins those things that happened on December 25th.
What American Minute, best place to get the book, or you just send people to Amazon? What do you prefer?
Either. If they go to AmericanMinute.com, they can see some of my other books.
Yeah.
And then also sign up for my American Minute. It's a little history email.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I noticed you wore Christmas green for our interview today. Bill, God bless you, man. So much great information. So it's so good to put this stuff in perspective and hold on to the good, get rid of some of that extra that's not. But appreciate you so much, man. Merry Christmas.
Well, hey, I appreciate you, Rick, and you're doing a tremendous work with Biblical Citizenship and Patriot Academy. And
Thank you. I
brag on you around the country, and I say that every church needs to have your program there, Biblical Citizenship, Patriot Academy. So
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. We'll look forward to having you back soon.
All right. God bless.
That was Bill Federer. What a treat to have him on. Every time, it's a treat. He really is a national treasure, and it's a blessing to know him. And to get to bring him here to you and share all that history is just always fun to me. I just think that's good stuff. And it's maybe something you could share. There's a lot of little golden nuggets in there that you could even share next year. Not next year. Well, share it next year too, but I meant next week during Christmas. You can absolutely share it with the family. Maybe even write down some, take some notes, go back and listen to the program at our website, take some notes and share that with friends and family when you're gathering for Christmas next week. They'll be amazed at your knowledge on those kind of things, because so much of that, man, I didn't know, and most people don't know, and you'll actually have a good time getting the chance to share it with your friends and family. So at the beginning of the program, we were talking about the continuing resolution and just some of this craziness that's going on in this interim. I forgot to mention, you know, one of the things that I was just having breakfast with some guys, and we were talking about the lame duck Congress and the fact that the 20th Amendment helped to shrink that. It had been, you know, sometimes 6 months between when the election would happen and Congress or the president would finally take office. And so that's a lot of time, 6 months for, yeah, shall we say, nefarious things to happen. Certainly policies could be implemented by the opposing party, the losing party. So one party's going out of office, been kicked out by the American people for having such bad policies, like what we're seeing right now in Washington, D.C., and a different party's coming in, going to have power, and now going to redirect the country in the direction that they think is best. And if you have this long lame duck period, it allows for the outgoing party that's already been ousted by the American people. Judgment's been cast. I mean, they've been told you did a lousy job and we're getting, you know, taking you out and putting somebody new in. And yet during that, at this point, you know, not quite 3 months. I mean, it's 2 months for the members of Congress and then about 2.5 months for the president. But that's still a long enough time in our technological world for them to quickly do damage. They can easily, you know, get things passed that lock the, you know, basically lock up the next administration and prevent them from being able to make the decisions and do things as they were elected to do. They can get things passed that they wouldn't normally get passed, but because it's the flurry of the, you know, Christmas and New Year's and people getting sworn in and all the craziness that goes during that, they can sneak more into these continuing resolutions and they can sneak more into other bills and get people to vote for things so they can go home. I mean, it's just not a good situation. And maybe the thing to do, perhaps we think about some sort of a, maybe it's a constitutional amendment to the 20th Amendment that shrinks that time and the new members of Congress and the president take office, you know, in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, unless there's a dispute. And if there's a dispute, then that person taking that office perhaps doesn't take office yet. But, you know, it shouldn't be that complicated to simply say, if you lose the election, you lose the ability to make law. And if there's things that if there's still some governing that needs to take place, execution of the law, if you need to keep, you know, continuing to, I mean, obviously run the military, deal with a national emergency, that sort of thing. Okay, that makes sense. We're all okay with that. What's not okay is for you to make policy, to make law during that interim. And so perhaps regardless of, you know, however long it is, maybe what we need to be concentrating on is a constitutional amendment that no law could be passed during that lame duck session. That what you can do is execute laws already passed. And maybe that means that Congress can only convene if it's an emergency. And that the president continues to execute the law, but that means he's having to or she's having to execute the law that's already been passed by Congress. Not unconstitutional executive orders that would make up new law or do things that the law doesn't allow for. That could, of course, be challenged in court. And, you know, you can do things to stop that eventually. But allowing them to just do business as usual allowing them to just go in and write entire policies and budgets for the next year or 2 years or pass things that they wouldn't normally get passed. And then once it's in law, folks, it is hard to reverse things. I think that's the real problem, and there's no reason for it. You cannot make a good argument for why these people during the lame duck need to go in and make new laws. I mean, if you've got one, I look forward to hearing it. But there's no reason if they knew that was coming, if we made this a constitutional amendment and we said that only the president, through their execution of the law as they normally have done throughout their 4-year term, can continue to do those things and oversee the agencies and all those things, but no, Congress may not pass a new law. If they knew that was the case, then they would get everything done before the election, just in case. If they knew that was the case, then they would work during that transition, during that interim period, to be prepared to make laws once they come back into session after the new election and the new members come in. I mean, look, I say that from experience in Texas. That's how it works. The legislature is not in session between the election and the swearing in of the new legislative body that was elected by the people. In fact, they haven't been in session for months usually, unless there's a special session that the governor calls, which is a mechanism to deal with any kind of an emergency or whatever. The governor can always call them into session. And I think you should have in every state a provision for the legislature to be able to call itself into session if the governor starts exercising emergency powers. That's a whole nother discussion and has to do with the way that we allowed COVID governors to become COVID tyrants and legislatures not actually in session to try to put a check on them. But to this whole issue of making new laws, spending money that wasn't authorized before, all of that there's no reason you should have to do that between November and the new Congress being sworn in. So that's a simple constitutional amendment. Now, listen, folks, you don't get that type of constitutional amendment passed in Congress. They're not going to do it. Don't forget to amend the Constitution. It either has to start in Congress with a 2/3 vote, or it starts with the states, and the states have to get together and do a 2/3 of the states that want to have a convention of states and send it off then to be ratified by the states, the individual state legislatures. Second step's the same for if it starts in Congress, then it goes to the states, and each individual state will take a vote on that amendment. But the only method that would work for this kind of thing, to because it limits Congress and it puts Congress in its box and it actually prevents them from abusing their power, Congress will never choose to do that to itself. So the states have to be the ones to do this. So this is just another argument for why we need to start doing Article 5 Convention of States on a regular basis. That should be something that the states are not afraid of doing, but they actually engage in doing. They look forward to doing that. Why not have the states gathering in a convention of states at least once every 10 years, maybe every year? And it could just be a 5-day session, a 1-week session. They quite literally would do nothing but review whether or not there's any bad Supreme Court decisions they need to overturn, or there's an executive order or some act of Congress that needs to be overturned by the states. That's the proper way to do it, through a constitutional amendment. And if they would meet on a more regular basis and propose those amendments in that meeting, you still have the ratification process to kill anything bad that came out of there. And that's the 38 states having to approve it. So anyway, I'm going too far down the rabbit hole, I know that, but I just couldn't get away from this continuing resolution thing and how bad it is to have people governing that have just been thrown out of office. That is only going to be stopped if we do a constitutional amendment to stop it. All right, folks, out of time. Have a fantastic Christmas, and I will see you around New Year's. God bless. You've been listening to At the Core with Walker Waldman and Ring Room. Little things can make a difference. A little note, little smile, the small stone that David hurled at Goliath, and precious little babies. When you sponsor an ultrasound at preborn, your gift, no matter how small, makes a difference in a big way. Who will this little baby become? What giants will this baby slay? How about the mother who was spared from unspeakable sorrow because of you? You never know the difference you're going to make with a donation of just $28 to introduce a mother to her child through ultrasound. It doubles a baby's chance at life. All you have to do is take a few small minutes to make a life-saving donation.
Preborn will take it from there as their network of clinics rescue 200 tiny babies every day and share God's love with mothers. Preborn has a 100% charity rating, so you can give with confidence. Get involved today by dialing #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.